seminars in here. This one is about starting board game company. Next one is about running Kickstarter. I mean, it's basically the same panel. I think we add another guy for the second one. So, you know, feel free to stay, I guess. Right? I think we might get more people to come in for the second one, but yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So it's really, no one's going to come kick us out after an hour. We're just going to kind of shift gears. That's all. Okay.
All right. So
no Kickstarter questions right now.
Yeah, please don't ask about Kickstarter.
I may defer them the second one. We'll see.
I wrote
a
Kickstarter question, too.
Oh, you did? Yeah, all right. Well, any indie board game panel always devolves into Kickstarter.
Yep.
It's like Godwin's Law for indie games. So I host a podcast called the BoardGame.Business Podcast with Brian over here, and it's all about the back ends of game design. So we don't talk about design or playtesting. There are plenty of podcasts for that. We talk about production, artist contracts, what print runs, that kind of stuff that you need to know if you're going to physically make your game. And so that's what I do. Zachary Strebeck here is the board game lawyer, or the game lawyer, I should say, and he hosts a podcast called Legal Moves. And you have a website. Remind me of the website.
You can go to gamelawyerblog.com.
There we go.
See my blog.
And so if you are like, well, yeah, what should an artist contract look like? You can hire him. You know, I'm going to license my game to an overseas company. You can hire him to make sure that you don't get screwed there. Mm-hmm. That's what he's there for. Brian Hink runs Overworld Games. They've done 6 successful Kickstarters, and they have several titles. Their new title out here at Gen Con is called Exposed. That's on sale in their booth. And
your first porn game?
Yes.
Yes. it's about pickpockets and thieves. Yeah, that's what it's about. Brian will be here. He has launched a successful indie board game company, talking about that. Mm-hmm. And then JT Smith has launched more companies than I can count. He's launched a whole bunch now. I want to mention my 2 favorites. The one you should be familiar with is the Game Crafter. And if you want to do a small run of your game, let's say I'm going to do 300 copies of my game. You can upload your files to his website, and you can print that. They'll even do fulfillment for your Kickstarter and kind of turnkey take it over for you and do a great job with that. If you're going to, we're going to do a bigger print run with a big print manufacturer, you can get your review copies done with the Game Crafter and sent out to reviewers ahead of time. And then the other business he recently launched that's my favorite is called Tabletop.Events. If you host a local con, or if you ever wanted to host your own local con, why aren't there more cons in my city? Tabletop Events is going to make it super easy to organize and launch your own con. I used it this year for my con, and it made my life so much easier. I'm definitely going to use it again next year. All right. So
I would actually like to plug the Board Game Business Podcast that you mentioned at the beginning. Really, I mean, if you're thinking about starting your own board game indie company, you should check out their back catalog. Don't just wait for the new episodes to come out, because they've already covered so many amazing topics in more detail than we're going to be able to do today in the panel. So,
thank you. And the Game Crafter podcast, too, is one that we subscribe to. So we're all podcasters, I guess. But
I listen to the Game Crafter one all the time.
Yeah, it's very similar, and we cover like similar topics, too, on the back end side of business. So I think we kind of steal each other's topics.
The back catalog again is good.
Oh, yeah, we should do an episode on that, yeah.
How to find an artist. Man, that was a good episode.
Yeah.
Right. And I've had all these guys on my podcast. Of course.
All right, so let's open it up with a question from the audience. And if you don't have any right now, I'll hit these guys with a question. But I want to give you a chance to ask questions. Then we have a question to start us off.
I have a question for them.
Yeah, okay, do it.
How many people have a board game company or own a board game company? Okay.
There's a few. All right.
How many people want to start a board game company? Okay.
Oh, and, all right. Well, you're in the right place.
All the other people, what are you doing here? No? Okay.
We're stalking it.
Now, you may ask.
Yeah, all right. So, launching an indie board game company. So, let's go back to something we talked about yesterday. I think it's important to talk about again, because the people who may have met it yesterday. JT, you recommended if you start a company and you have partners, you don't do an equal partnership.
Right.
And don't split it down the middle like 50-50. Why is that?
Think of the filings for your business like a prenup of a marriage. At the time that you are going into it, you're happy and blissful, but there can be egos that get involved or any number of things that can go wrong and cause bad blood. And the way that you are able to make decisions when there is bad blood, even if you're not splitting up the company, even if it's just that you have to make decisions while there is bad blood, having someone be the one in charge solves that problem. So I recommend a minimum kind of 51-49 split. With my business partners, I'm actually 60, and they're each 20. But I just I really can't recommend that enough. I know too many of my business friends that have started 50-50 partnerships, and then it caused them no end of pain. So
I will interject here and say that there's different types of interests in a company that you can have. So if you form an LLC, if you form a corporation, you're kind of stuck in how corporations work. But if you're forming an LLC, you have a lot of room to play. So you could have a capital interest, which is like if you sell the company, you get 50% of whatever the sales were or the sale of the company was. You get a voting interest. So votes could be separated. Let's say I get 3 votes and you get 1 vote or something like that, or I get 80%. And then you can have profit interests, lost interests. So let's say your profit interests will shift dynamically depending on how much work you've put into the game. So let's say I put in 80 hours and you put in 40 hours. Then I'm going to get 2/3 of the profits and you get only 1/3, right? So you can kind of fudge all that stuff rather than being equal, and that's fine. So there are ways to play with it.
So I could come to you as a client, and I could set up a board game company where one person has control. So in the event the partnership goes sideways, mm-hmm. that person can, you know, the company doesn't implode.
Right.
But financially, the partners are getting money at a more equal level.
Yes.
If your board game company actually makes money.
Yeah. So if your board game makes money, yeah, I mean, you can do it dynamically. There's a million different ways you can do it. You know, with an LLC, you're pretty flexible, so... whatever you dream.
If I was coming to you and I had like a 2-person team, what structure would you recommend I set up?
It depends. So for me, it depends on what you want to do with the company. If you're looking to get a bunch of investors and all that, and you know, in board games, it's probably not happening. So it's usually not a concern. But if you're going to make mobile games or smartphone apps or something like that, maybe you were planning to expand outside of just tabletop games. If you wanted to get investors, you're probably going to want to form a Delaware corporation. But for most of the people here who want to start a company, an LLC is probably the most flexible and easy thing to run. Running a corporation is a little more complicated, and you have different layers of taxes, and there's all kinds of complications. With an LLC, things are pretty straightforward. The money flows right through the LLC directly to your personal income taxes. The voting is a lot easier. You cannot require annual meetings, all the stuff that with a corporation you have to do. So the compliance and all of that is much easier with an LLC. So generally that's what's recommended for a small board game company where you just want to take in money, take it out of the company and put it in your bank account, and that's all you want to do.
That'd be the dream for the small board game company, actually make
making
money.
The money.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a question over here.
You can do that, and you can license it. If you want to keep ownership of the game to yourself and license it to the company, I suppose that's fine. Generally, I recommend that the LLC itself owns all the IP, just because it makes the LLC valuable.
Also can fix some liability issues.
Sure. That was what I was trying to spit out. if the LLC owns the IP and the IP is infringing even inadvertently on something else, the LLC is going to get sued, and that's where the limited liability in the LLC helps you, because if they don't come after your personal assets, they're going to go after the LLC's assets, which is that IP and any money that came from the game, but it's not going to come from your house or your car or whatever else, you know, your bank accounts. Okay?
Yes.
The filing fee and your lawyer fee, and that's about it. A lot of times, one issue that happens with LLCs and companies in general is undercapitalization. So if you don't put enough money into it to run the business, they do what's called piercing the corporate veil, where they go through the LLC's limited liability and directly to you. So you want to avoid the problem that I just talked about, where they come after your personal assets, by putting money in the LLC. Now, if the business doesn't actually require capital, so it's just all intellectual and you're just designing a game, I don't think that you basically need to have as much capital as is required to run the business. I think that's the rule, and that may be like more of a tax thing. I don't know. For board games.
Was your question along the same lines? Or
I was going to be more like, is there a point where you can become too big to be an LLC? I mean, that's kind of the dream.
Sony Computer Entertainment America is an LLC. Okay. You know, I mean, they're pretty big. So
it's good for a small company, but it's good even if you become
The reason, but the reason Sony is an LLC is because they're a subsidiary of Sony in Japan or whatever, who is an a corporation. And so the stocks that are traded on the stock market, all that is the corporation stocks. So, you know, they're big, but they're still a subsidiary of, and it depends. So too big is like when you want to do an IPO or something like that. You can't do that as an LLC. You're going to want to convert to a corporation. Initial public offering. If you're doing tabletop games, it's probably not something you ever have to worry about. So don't worry. Cool. Yeah.
Well, JT, how did you set up your businesses? What format did you use?
Every one of my businesses is different based on the type of business that it is. And some of them restructure over time, too. For like the Game Crafter started as an LLC, and we restructured it as a C Corp a couple of years ago because we're in a growth phase, and we want to manage our taxes differently than we were as an LLC with an S filing. So we changed around those things because there were monetary reasons or tax reasons to do that. What state you file in will determine whether or not you want to go an LLC or a corp. What you're doing with the money, how the partners are divided, all kinds of things. And a lot of it has more to do with taxes than it does with legal stuff, but it could also have to do with filing fees. Like in certain states, it's really cheap to file a corporation, but it's expensive to do an LLC, or vice versa. So the size of your company has really nothing to do, to my knowledge, with whether you do an LLC or a corporation, or whether you have an S filing attached to either of those. It really comes down to how the money is moving through the company and what you want to do with that, as to which one you want to choose.
California, from what I'm from, it's $800 annually for a corporation, whether you make any money or not.
It's true. It's all. I think the same holds for a corporation, but if you're an S-Corp, I think for the first couple of years you have a break on that. It's like $200 or something. So it's cheaper to do an S-Corp. I don't know.
Brian, how's your company set up?
LLC.
LLC, there we go. Yeah.
But so my business partner's in South Dakota. I'm in California. So we do have to be registered in both states. So I still am stuck paying the $800 a year, you know, in California, but also in South Dakota, there's a fee for that too. It's way, way smaller, somewhere around $100. So that's how we're set up. So
yes, another question.
Is there a tax advantage between like an LLC or an S corp or a corporation?
Yeah. So a corporation is taxed twice. It's taxed. The corporation itself is taxed, pays income taxes on the money it receives, and then when it distributes money to you, you then pay taxes as well. So there's two levels of taxation. With an LLC or an S-Corp, it's called pass-through taxation. And I'm not a tax guy. These are like the basics. The money flows through the entity and goes directly to your personal. So you only tax once on whatever you take out of it. Right.
Which is great for most board game companies. That's probably what you're going to want to do. Right. If you're in my situation with the Game Crafter, it's a very capital intensive business. We have to buy all kinds of really expensive equipment. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we want to keep money in the company to be able to do those kinds of purchases. And so there's during our growth phase, switching to a corporation, the double taxation didn't really matter because we're not taking a whole lot of money out. We're mostly keeping it in the company to grow it faster. So. And that way we're not paying taxes because corporate taxes are less than the taxes that you would pay directly to yourself.
Sure.
There we go. In the back.
So you're probably in a pretty interesting position to see the inner workings of some gaming companies. I'm wondering, what are some of the biggest pitfalls that you see? Is it lousy product or advertising? Bad management?
All of the above. Well, I mean, if you don't have a good, you know, it's sort of like the sine qua non or whatever. You need a great product, right, to sell that product, right? You need great marketing to get the word out. I mean, you need all of these things, right?
You can screw it up in so many ways. Yeah. You can screw up your board game company in so many ways.
Well,
any of those.
Let me give you an example. So this little guy's local to us, and so they had a game they wanted to launch, and so they had a game. They had tested it. It was a decent game, playtest-wise. They didn't have a big social media following or a big buzz or mailing list built up for the game. And they spent like $6,000 on art for their game. They set up a company for their game and spent some more money on that. Then they bought a bunch of advertising online for their Kickstarter campaign. And then it failed to fund. And so now they had put thousands and thousands of dollars into something that could not even reach its funding goal and made $0. And so that's the kind of the thing I think I back a lot of Kickstarter campaigns, more than 400, And most of those board game campaigns, and I see a lot of them, that they spend all this money up front on art and advertising and setting it up, my game's going to be a big hit, and then it's not, and that's just a sunk cost you don't get back. Yeah, yeah, let me go with the gentleman in the near back.
Ooh. Produce the game, because I personally just produced a few prototypes of my game, found out that it is very scalable up to, say, a small run of, say, 250 to 500. I could manage that personally, kind of working with several different producers. Is there a point at which you say, okay, I kind of need to hand up and say, I want you to find everyone to make this game?
Let's have JT answer the small run, and then Brian talk about the bigger run. So, JT, I'm going to do 300 copies of my game.
I want to clarify something. I want to just make sure that I understand. So, in your case, you're saying, I sourced the box from that guy, I sourced the board from that guy, I sourced some parts from another guy, you assembled it, and now you can sell it as your short run.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's a third way other than what you were about to talk about, or what we were just doing. So, yeah. It's all up to your comfort level. That you will probably make the most money, if you're not counting your time, right. You will probably make the most money from a short run or even a medium run doing that, what you're about to do, sourcing it from all these different vendors. The one thing that you have to concern yourself with there is the shipping costs from all these different places. You're taking in, you're paying shipping on each thing. By putting it to one source, you're not having to deal with that. But then, on the other side of things, you can also outsource a short run to some place like me, with the Game Crafter. You can run 300 copies, and we will actually manufacture it, we'll assemble it, all of the pieces, we'll put the components together, we will put it in a shipping box and mail it to every single one of the people that buy it from you. So that you're completely hands-off. It's a 100% turnkey solution. And then you go to the bigger guys, and I'll let him talk about the manufacturing part, but then the bigger guys often aren't going to do that last part that I just talked about, where they're handling the shipping part. They'll manufacture it, and then you'll find yet another company that would handle the drop shipping aspect of it. Talk more about, like, how do you find the bigger publishers and how do you deal with...
Brian, have you ever sourced components from multiple sources, or you always have one?
No, I've never done that. It's really interesting. I'm glad you brought it up, because it's something that I think is a valid option, you know, especially when you're... if you're just starting out, then you can, you really do have that control, and you can see what components work and which ones don't, and then you can switch them out too really easily. So that hands-on thing, I think, is also going to provide you with the most learning too.
Mm-hmm.
The Game Crafter too, we use. I think you'll find too, as your company grows, your time gets so much more limited. And so there's certain things that I will gladly pay someone else to do so I don't have to. So, like, we do all of our, we just sent out 60 playtest copies of one of our upcoming games. And I don't have time to make all those myself. All I had to do was do it once. I uploaded it to the Game Crafter and just shipped it out. They went out to everybody. And I didn't have to spend all that time doing that. So also starting out, you have the time to do that. And that's, I think, I would say, yeah, go for it. And then when you find that you don't anymore, you know, then you can step up to the Game Crafter or someone else.
How do you go about sourcing your vendors for printing and drop shipping and all that? I think that would be interesting for him.
It would be. There are so many manufacturing options. You could even start with countries. You can have it manufactured in the U.S. You can have it manufactured in Europe, in China. So you, and that's going to be, which one you choose depends on how you set up your supply chain.
From a straight profit standpoint, is it viable to have a game these days solely produced domestically?
Yes, if it's a card game. If it's solely cards, like a card game, you can get very competitive pricing in the U.S., and also it may make your shipping and fulfillment cheaper to do because, again, it's in the U.S., and you're primarily going to be mailing to U.S. and Canada backers. And so you can actually – and the the lead time may be less as well. It doesn't have to sit on a boat for 6 weeks coming over from China. Yep. And so you can fulfill more rapidly, or you can get it in time to take it to a con. So if you're doing a card game, I think that domestically it's very attractive to print a card game domestically.
And communication, too. So you can speak to someone who is, you know, natively speaks English. We've had a lot of communication issues with folks in other countries, and so it's a barrier you have to overcome.
Also, depending on your volume, there are companies here in the United States that can compete with Chinese prices as long as you go up to larger volumes. I'm thinking of in Michigan, there's what do they call it?
Delano?
Delano.
I don't know which one it is. Yeah.
Whatever it is. In Michigan, they if you're at like 2,500 to 5,000 copies rather than kind of on the lower end, their prices are competitive with China's prices, and you're produced domestically. So now not only are they the same price, but then you're also not paying for the shipping, and you have the stuff faster. So that's actually a pretty cool deal. And then the other thing about profit is you have to realize that profit is all about what you set your price to. So if your price is just stupidly low, you're not going to make a profit no matter where you get it made. So price is simply what you negotiate with your customer to pay. So if they're willing to pay a higher price, you can get one copy and still make a profit on it, because profit is the difference between price and cost, right? So so many people go into Kickstarter starting their business of any kind. Forget Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. Starting their business of any kind, and they start out wanting to be the low price leader. Mm-hmm. Do not do that. That's the wrong way to go.
Yeah.
So especially, you know, in an indie situation, you're a bespoke product. At an indie situation, there's a premium for being a bespoke product.
You'll almost certainly hit some snag of some unforeseen cost, and if you cut your margins low, now you're in the red. Now you're in the negative, and that happens a lot. Brian, you printed your first Good Cop Bad Cop domestically. Is that correct?
No. The first edition. No, that one. Well, yeah, I guess the first one was we at least had options to go with. Depending on how well we did in our first one, we were either going to go domestically, with a few different companies, and then if it got to a certain point, then we were going to go with a printer overseas in China, and so that allowed us to use the right partner for the right number of backers, instead of just saying, you know, I have to hit 1,500 backers, I'm going to make sure I hit that, or I'm going to base everything based on that. But you might hit 300.
I think you had told me you had three tiers. You know, this many backers, I'm Game Crafter. This many backers, I'm domestic card printing. This many backers, I go to China.
Yep, exactly. But one thing is that it's not all about price either. I think a lot of people look for, I need to find the cheapest way to manufacture my game. And it's not about that, especially when you're just starting out. You should pay extra for someone who's going to make your job easier and you're going to be able to learn from. So there are companies who will charge a higher price, but they will allow you to, they will really hold your hand through the process and make sure you're making the right game, you know, for yourself. The more you do it, the more you can kind of figure out the cheapest way to do it, but don't try to do that right away.
I think like Panda.
So Panda's a really good one. Yep.
Maybe AdMagic.
AdMagic is a good one too. Both of them have really strong customer service teams, some based in the US. So you're calling somebody in the U.S. and they're gonna help you through the entire process.
Mm-hmm. I call that lessons cost money, good ones cost lots.
Yeah.
It's very easy if you manufacture in China to have something go horribly wrong and you have the language barrier. And so for the first game, I don't know if I would take that risk of picking some Chinese manufacturer that you don't know that well and has communication that's very challenging or lackluster. I want to take the gentleman on the right here.
So for distribution after publishing, I know that just reading through Jamie Stegmaier's book and his blog that he ended up with Viticulture for sending out through Amazon distribution in North America and also in Europe. What are some other options for distribution that you guys have used or that you guys have seen that have been successful domestically and also like if you want to do that?
That's for Brian.
Yeah, is Amazon still the
Amazon is good, and I know other people who use them, but they're also more expensive. You're going to pay them a higher rate to fulfill your game than their competitors. So they may be very reliable and a safe choice, but they're going to cut down your margin because they're going to cost more.
They're also very complicated, too.
Yeah, they have a certain way of doing it.
Yeah, they have fulfillment centers all over the place. You have to send different amounts of games to different ones. It's kind of a mess. Nobody really uses Fulfillment by Amazon for board games anymore. They did for a while, but not many people do. You can, but it doesn't seem to be worth the price. That is a very good question, though. How do you distribute your game? So many ways to do it. You can go to conventions, so let's say you print your game through crowdfunding, through do it on your own, however you make it happen. You're going to have a whole bunch of copies left over. So you can. There are so many ways to do it. You can go to a convention and sell it yourself. You can sell it on Amazon. You can just become a seller on Amazon and put your game up there. Go to conventions, get people excited about it, send it to reviewers. Then the only place they'll be able to get it is Amazon. So, but they can type it into Amazon, where a lot of people buy board games, pick up a copy of your game.
So we know a guy locally, and so he made a game about the national parks, a visit to the national parks, and the cost to produce his game was so high that he couldn't get into retail distribution. Because if I want to go to like a distributor who's then going to send it out to retail stores, they want to be able to buy the game for less than half of the MSRP. And he couldn't do that because his MSRP, he wanted to be $50, and his cost of producing the game was more than half. And so he shipped them all to his garage or his basement, and he goes around to local cons and sells the game at local cons. The only way to buy it is the con or through his website, and that way he maintains a healthy margin, and that's what he wanted to do. And he just entered Mensa, and he won the Mensa Award for his game, which will help him get more sales. The second option might be, I ship extra copies of my game to a distributor in the U.S. if they'll take me, or a consolidator.
Well, you could try for a distributor. You could sell to, there's five big distributors in the U.S., so you can try to get them to buy copies of your game afterwards. If you can get them to buy copies, they're going to buy 200, 300, 400, 500 more copies. You can sell a lot of games that way, but if it's your first game, they're not going to buy it from you.
Unless your game is super hot for some reason,
yeah. Right.
It's crazy successful that maybe they pick it up.
There's a trick I've used that I don't think I've ever heard anybody else using. Instead of going into distribution with a game, you can actually contact the biggest store you can find in every given country that you want to distribute your game, and just see if you can work a direct deal with them. So, for example, The Captain Is Dead is sold on thegamecrafter.com in the U.S., but in Canada, it's sold on Board Game Bliss, and he just buys 50 copies at a time. We ship them across the border. That's the way you get it in Canada without having to pay the extra shipping from coming from directly from the Game Crafter. We do a similar thing with a company in the U.K. and a similar thing with a company in Australia. And so we have effectively avoided the distribution model of trying to get into distribution, even though actually a distributor offered to distribute it for us. But I get a better margin by going direct to these places anyway. So anyway, that's just another trick you can use.
Yeah, that's a good tip.
Is the National Park game in the various gift shops in National Parks?
No. The challenge, if you have a game like, oh, this would be great for a museum gift shop, or this would be great for a National Park gift shop, those are all independently operated by the local fiefdom of bureaucracy that manages that gift shop. So you have to negotiate with each and every one to get your game in there. Like, I had a museum game, and there was no way that's gonna happen. Yeah,
but still, if he wants the price to be $50 and it costs him $30 to make it, he's going to have to sell it to that gift shop for $25.
Right? Yep.
So he's going to take a $5 loss on it. So he can't sell it to like gift shops like that.
Yeah.
But the other one we didn't touch on yet was the consolidator. So we talked about, if we're just talking about the U.S., five major distributors in the U.S., there's another layer. So there's the consumer buys it from the retailer buys it from the distributor. This distributor actually usually doesn't buy it straight from a publisher. They buy it from a consolidator. So that consolidator works with lots of different publishers, and then they get all their games. They ship them in a big crate or bunch of crates to the distributors so to save on shipping. And then there's other reasons to do it too. But so if you can get hooked up with a consolidator, become one of their clients, the biggest one is PSI. And Impressions is another big one. And then there's some other smaller ones as well.
So I print my game, and pallets of my game go to the consolidator. And from the consolidator, boxes of my games go to the distributor. Yep. And from the distributor, copies of my games go to the retailer.
The consolidator also acts as your warehouse. So all of your extra games, they don't go in your garage. They go in the consolidator's warehouse. And then you don't have to manage that as well.
And everybody takes a cut down the road to make it happen.
All of those layers, everybody takes a cut.
Well, that's why, what do they say? From your manufacturing costs, it should be, what, six times or something?
Ideally,
common. Okay. Yeah, it's an estimate. Okay. Very definitely a ballpark estimate.
So what are the chances of a first time? So you just started your game company. If you just have a game, what are the chances of getting into a consolidator?
If you just have one game, it's similar to a distributor. It's going to be a tough sell to get into a consolidator. It's usually you have to, have a few games that have been somewhat successful. They need a track record.
One of my friends is the top board game salesman in the country. He works for ACD, which is the second largest distributor. His general rule of thumb is they won't even talk to a publisher unless they have at least three SKUs.
Yep.
And those SKUs also have to have a number of other attributes, like they consider Board Game Geek rating, okay. They consider how many have they sold already, a bunch of different things. Also, of course, there's a whole bunch of terms that go with it, like if this doesn't sell, I need to be able to give it back to you and you give me my money back, stuff like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, you have to remember, they're not doing you a favor. They're in a business, right? They want to actually sell these games to end users.
My friend from Dave Ferguson from Castle Productions, he had a game that's moderately successful, but he only has one SKU, and he encountered exactly that barrier. Like, we are not even going to look at you until you have three titles. Come back when you have three titles. I'm going to take the gentleman in the way in the back.
So let's play a game and build out the price structure, the margin
Well, if you want to start with, you can use the 5X model to start with. So that's your manufacturing cost times 5, $50. So your price is $50.
That's MSRP.
Yeah.
MSRP is $50. Got me $10 to manufacture it.
So when a consumer buys it, they're going to pay $50 for it.
Theoretically.
The retailer will buy it from the distributor for $25. The distributor will buy it from the consolidator for, so it would be 40% of the MSRP plus 40% of 50.
$20?
Sure.
Okay.
$20. So then the consolidator will buy it from the publisher. They'll take somewhere between 15 to 20% of the money that's left over, the 40% that's left over. So... Yeah. So it'll depend on the deal, that you make with them and that kind of thing. But 15 to 20% of that. The rest is what you have. So $20 is what we had before the consolidator.
Yep.
So what's 80% of that? It's 80% of $20?
16, yeah.
$16. So now you just made $6 on your game, but you had to, and the consolidator will pay shipping to the distributors, so you don't have to worry about that. You do have to worry about the shipping. You have to pay the shipping from your manufacturer to your consolidator. Right. So we'll say that was $2 a game. Right. You just made $4 on each game that you sold.
For a $50 game, so for a big ticket game. Now if we're trying to do that with a $20 game or $25 game, it gets even more challenging.
You didn't really make $4.
Oh, that's true. Yep.
Because you also still have to market the game. The distributor will not do that. The first week that it comes out, the distributor will tell their – sometimes they will tell their retailers that the game exists.
Yeah.
But that's as much as they're going to do for you. So you still have to ship stuff to demo kits to the retailers themselves and maybe posters and things like that. You still have to market the game at conventions, all kinds of stuff.
You have to pay the artist. You have to pay the graphic designer.
Yep.
They may get a cut from that. You have to pay the art. Yeah. Illustrator, graphic designer, game designer. So everybody takes a cut of that $4 of every game.
So the guy doing the National Parks game, he doesn't have to pay the whole chain, right? But now his sales are, he only makes the sales that he makes himself, or he makes them word of mouth. And so his sales are small time, bigger margin, smaller time. If I'm in distribution, and I get into retail, and my game sells pretty well, like Brian's game, Good Cop, Bad Cop, is going through 4 print runs. It's selling well, even though he only makes like $1 a copy. If he sells thousands and thousands of copies, then that starts to add up.
Basically, what we're saying is don't quit your day job.
Yes. Please don't.
I saw a head on the right side of the room. I don't want to ignore the right side. Yes.
So, we talked before about sending out a few review copies before you do your finish campaign to get your production run going. What about your, like you mentioned, board game reviews? What other kind of like industry magazines and things like that would you do post production to get like running for awards or those kind of bigger?
So this is after I complete my print run?
Yes. It's published. It's
my game's published, and I want to get it more attention. Where do I pay for advertising and or what contests do I enter?
Yes.
Okay. I'll talk about the contests, and then I'll have you guys talk about the advertising or marketing.
Sure.
Yeah, so there are various contests that you can enter. So Mensa's one where you mail copies to their annual contest. They need 8 copies or something like that, and you have to go through their process, and then they test it. If they like it, you get the Mensa MindGate Award, which may sell you additional copies. That's one that you can enter. There are various other contests you can enter. I'm having trouble thinking them off the top of my head. I know we did an episode about this.
Origins.
The Origins Game Awards. Yeah, you can do that. You can try to make the hotness list on BGG if you release at, say, BGGCon in November.
Spiel der Haars.
For your game to qualify for the Spiel der Haars, your game has to be published in German in Germany within 2 years of the consideration period. And your game, the way the Spiel der Haars works, is the jury of the Spiel der Haars, they will play your game, each individual jury member, this is not an exaggeration, 50 to 100 times. So your game play has to hold up that many times. So some of the games I designed, I do not want to play them that many times. There's not many that are going to hold up 100 plays. And the game has to be exciting when they're playing it for the 70th time. And so that's really hard to win that award. But if you do, that will sell an additional 250,000 copies of your game.
Yes.
That's a big deal. If you are an indie designer and your game isn't published yet, there are a bunch of unpublished contests you can enter, like the Cardboard Edison Awards, they do through their blog, or the SaltCon Ion Award, that can get your unpublished design more attention before you publish it, in order to help get it some more accolades or more attention. I want to have these guys talk about advertising. And JT, you might want to talk about your contests for unpublished things and the awards you guys do.
That's what I was going to say, too, just to kind of lead into that. The Game Crafter, they have a lot of contests, design contests. And so as a publisher, you know, I get pitched a lot of games. And if I, you know, it means a lot to me if someone has entered into a Game Crafter competition or has won a Game Crafter competition. It's like a, you know,
Jeremy, or like a top 8 finalist.
Jeremy, yeah, you know,
I mean,
yeah.
A top 8 out of 300 entries.
Yeah, because it's hard to get attention from a publisher as a newer designer. And you talk about building your resume as a game designer. That's the best way to do it, is to enter those types of contests. And then if you come to a game with me and you tell me that, you know, we won this contest, or yeah, we were a finalist, that makes me like, oh, okay, you know, I'm going to really pay attention to this game.
There are a lot of game design contests. You mentioned the, I forget which one, Cardboard Edison.
Cardboard Edison, yeah.
BGDF has contests monthly as well. And those have different contest has different levels of prestige associated with it, of course, mainly based on how much judging is involved in it, and also how many entries there are. You know, if there's only 5 entries in a contest, it's not really hard to win it, right? So... anyway, the Game Crafter, we run 4 contests a year through our site, and depending on the contest, we'll have anywhere from about 30 entries all the way up to 200 entries per contest. And there's usually cash prizes. Sometimes there's publishing deals. There's all kinds of things that come with them. But the big thing is that we have a very meticulous judging process that goes over 3 stages, and as a result of that, if you're able to make it to the top, you know, 7, which is the finalists, that is a really big deal. Every single game that has won a contest on the Game Crafter has either gone on to a successful Kickstarter or has been picked up by a publisher, every single one of them for the last 5 years. In addition, most of the people that have made it into the top 7 of each of those contests have either gone on to a successful Kickstarter or been picked up by a publisher too. Not all, but many. So those kinds of things can really help you get out there, because it means that your game was vetted by a group of people that have no relationship to you and said, this is good. So
versus someone I paid to do a review for my Kickstarter.
Right.
And I buy a lot of games. I buy a lot of those games because I know that that to get that far in the contest means a lot. That's a good game. Like when Starving Artists won and hit Kickstarter, not only a whole bunch of my people, friends backed it, like, oh, this game looks amazing, because it won the contest.
Starving Artists is a great game.
Yeah, and so that gives it, it's kind of a seal of quality there.
Right.
And if you launch a Kickstarter campaign, what a great thing to just put right there somewhere on that page that you won that contest, or you were a finalist in that contest.
I'll put one more, then we'll ask about advertising. If you take your game to a Protospiel or Unpub events, they have little badges that you can put on your Kickstarter page or on your game. This is Protospiel tested or Unpub tested. Not everybody cares about that, but people in the hobby and other designers care about that your game survived a Protospiel or Unpub event where it may have faced a higher threshold of scrutiny and really gave your game an acid test that may have made it better. And so that means more to me when I'm on Kickstarter looking at games, like, oh, this game actually went to 3 Protospiel events, that this game has actually been tested in a way that I have confidence. It was, all my friends like it, and Grandma likes it, so now we're on Kickstarter. So I know that they actually did put their game through a level of testing that I have more confidence in.
Right.
Let me ask you guys about advertising. So a game that's already out, it's published already. Do you do any advertising for it? Do you pay for any advertising in magazines or online?
They call it the black hole of marketing. It's really easy that a lot of people will take your money to advertise your game. So you need to be really careful about where you put that. So it's just one of those things that just be careful about how you do it. For and it's going to be different for each company. For us, we have a lot of social games, and we our games try to create an experience that people are going to remember. So I want people to play my game as much as possible, and they'll have those experiences, and then I think they'll buy it. So I put all my money into that. So I have there are a couple of companies I work with, Envoy, Double Exposure Envoy. They're a program that I will pay them to organize my a bunch of events all over the country where they call them heralds. I will send them copies of my game. They'll get certified in those games that they know how to play it, and then they will hold events, and they'll hold a certain number of events. Play those games there. They'll tweet about it, put it on Facebook. So we'll get a lot of marketing that way. It's expensive, but that's where most of my my marketing budget goes for after like a Kickstarter campaign.
Live demos.
And there's also Indie Game Alliance, who I also work with. So they do a very similar thing. It's going to be a lot less. You don't have to pay them as much to do that kind of thing. But they also won't get it out to as many people as someone like Envoy. But I work with both of those companies to do that as much as possible. And that's where I've chosen to put my money.
And I should say that has, because those demos are done in retail stores, that curries you more favor with retailers. The retailers,
yep.
More likely to carry your game,
yep.
Or make it a priority to help sell it at retail.
Yep.
That you are, well, I'm going to have someone come into your store on release weekend and demo the game and teach people how to play. That means a lot to a retailer.
Yep.
JT, any after the game is published, do you for Captain is Dead or anything else, do you put any money into anything after it's already published?
Well, first, I think what he's doing is great. Getting it out where live people can play it as a form of marketing, that's good. It's interesting. I've never heard the black hole of marketing, but I have a similar term. So I call advertising a hole in the internet where you throw your money. Advertising I don't do in any form for any of my businesses. I do not pay money for advertising ever because it never works. I have done lots of different, over the last 20 years of making businesses, I have done a lot of different types of advertising and it does not work. Conventions work. Go into a store and demo your game, that works. The other thing that works is reviewers. If a reviewer says, I want to have a copy of your game, I will instantly ship them a copy for free without question. It is just what I do. So getting it out, if a podcast is interested, good. You're going to do a write-up, good. You're going to do a video, great. You're going to take it to a convention because you want to run a couple copy, or you want to run a couple events at that convention for me? Wonderful. I'm going to ship you a free copy of that game. Those are kinds of things that I spend money on. I don't spend money on banner ads or Facebook ads or Google ads or any of that. I've never seen any of it work in the 20 years I've done business, regardless of industry. So if you do spend money in those regards, though, make sure that you're ridiculously targeted. You want to get as narrow a group as possible. And note that their job is not to sell your product. Those ads, it's not to sell your product. It's to get eyeballs on your product. Mm-hmm. So whatever they're clicking through to has to sell the product. And that's the big thing that most people forget about. They spend all this money on these things. They get the eyeballs there, and then they fall dead. It's wasted. So if you do get the eyeballs, if you're going to pay to get the eyeballs, then you need to make sure that whatever you have on the other end of that link is so compelling that they're willing to pull out their pocketbook. So
let me give you two more tips related to that. Brian's done this. I know Matthew's done this. If they did buy ads on BoardGameGeek or KickTrack, they created a unique Bitly URL, and that was what's in the ad. And so then they go get the statistics from Bitly about how many click-throughs they actually got on that ad. Not what the advertisers tells them, but how many click-throughs on that URL they actually got. Or for reviewers, they give them a unique URL as well to see, you know, how much traffic did I actually get off of that source that I put there. And sometimes it's very surprising how much comes through. One more thing that J.T. Brisley mentioned on for conventions, and then is that a lot of conventions, they have a game library where you can check out a game and play it. So if you are at the point where you're established, you have a website, you may want to have a page on your website where people can apply to get a copy for their game library. And so they say, hey, we're so-and-so con. We have 1,000 people come out and play games, or 3,000 people. Will you mail us a copy for our game library? And then people check it out of the game library. They play, oh, this game is fun. I'll go buy this game. Relatively low cost for you to reach that audience. Jamie Stigmeier is a big fan of Play to Win, where he mails copies to conventions where they say, hey, if you play this game at the convention, we put in your name in a raffle, and we're going to give it away at the end of the convention. Somebody will win this game, so that motivates people to play it and not just have it sit on the library shelf. I'm not sure how cost-effective that is. If you had a relatively cheap game, that may be worthwhile. Brian's experimenting with that now.
Oh, I'll do it for our games. It worked perfectly. Because we have a cheap game that plays a lot of people, and when people play it, they want to buy it. So I'll do any play to win event I can possibly.
So for Good Cop Bad Cop, because it plays eight,
yeah.
You get 50 people play at the convention. At least three of them are going to buy it, and that now you break even, and you're making money off that again because you picked up those people.
But a bigger box game, it doesn't work. It's not cost effective. It depends on the game.
Just if you're using different Bitly URLs and all that, you can set up Google Analytics, I believe, to track their movement through your. So they click through on your Bitly URL, and you can see if it meets a goal of them purchasing the product, or I don't know, signing up for your mailing list or something like that. Mm-hmm. So just a little tip.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a question over here.
Okay. I've got a normal 9-to-5 job. On evenings and weekends, I also do freelance animation work and set up as an LLC. Mm-hmm. I come up with an idea for a board game or a card game or whatever. Am I better off publishing that under the LLC I already have created, or should I spin off a new LLC even though it's going to cost me more?
Ooh.
Yeah.
It's a great lawyer question.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really see a reason why you would create a separate entity for that unless there was a reason to compartmentalize. You know, sometimes, so when someone makes... Let's say you're a production company and you make a bunch of different films, right? I think for accounting purposes and for legal purposes, they're going to create a single-purpose entity for each film, right? So it's going to be, Iron Man 1 Productions or something like that, right? And that's specifically for that. Although I think Marvel Studios just has their own overall thing. So they don't always do it, but that's the reason why they do it. I think, and it keeps the accounting separate. So actually, you can kind of do some screwy accounting where you're basically paying yourself, even though it's technically... this is how Hollywood works and how they screw you on royalties and things like that, because they're basically paying themselves for doing these services, but it all on the books, it looks like they're spending all the money that the movie's making. For just a one person who's just putting out games, I mean, there really isn't a huge reason to complicate things. And, it's just more paperwork and more nonsense and more taxes. And I don't know.
I'm gonna give you one more option. In that case, you might want to take that game to the publisher and say, hey, I have the design, and I did the artwork, and the artwork's done too because I'm an animator. And that publisher may have a lot more reach, and they're going to take care of the manufacturing and the distribution and the advertising, the marketing, and they're going to take all that hassle away from you so you can keep creating games and doing the artwork. And if the art is good and the game is good, that's a – look, ooh, I get a two-for-one by picking up this game, that I got the game and the artwork, and if they're thematically connected, that may be appealing to a publisher, and you don't have to do all that labor of the production and distribution and marketing.
One more thing to say. One thing you could do is, rather than create separate entities, you do it all under one entity, but you do what's called a fictitious business name or a DBA. So, like, let's say you're Animation LLC, and then you're going to create, you're going to do business for your games as Animation Games. That's it. So you file a DBA in whatever county you're located in, and I think they publish it in the newspaper for 4 weeks or something like that.
If you still have a newspaper.
Well, it's weird. Or they like post it up at the library or something weird like that. It's very archaic and weird, but it's the way it's still done. So each county, even in California, each county is different, has a different procedure. Wherever you live, it'll be different. But, yeah, you can do that, and just basically you're releasing a game, even though it's still the LLC, because now you've connected this fictitious business name to your LLC. It looks like it's a separate entity, but it really is the same thing.
And you still have the protection of the LLC.
Sure. Yeah. You're just doing business as a different name. That's all.
Brian?
So I guess I the moral of the story maybe is don't worry too much about it. You can always change it later. Like, you just went through a restructuring, right? Sure, it wasn't easy, but you can always change it later. So don't let it stop you from creating cool things. And because, you can always...
All right, we're going to take about one or two more questions, and then we should officially wrap up the first panel, or the second panel, which is a slightly different, which is all about Kickstarter.
Yeah.
I'm gonna take the gentleman in the back with the glasses on.
I was just
going to
say, all that comes down to is it just comes down to your tactics and how efficiently you come down on your taxes, mm-hmm. and how much you have to lose and how much you need to protect. And that's the only two things that that way.
Yeah, and also say have a tax advisor on hand. You know, have your accountant or CPA or tax lawyer or something like that to run all this stuff by. Because don't trust me, because I'm not a tax lawyer.
It's like the gentleman in the front.
So, tying to what we talked about just now, how much should I expect to get paid by a big publisher, me being the game designer who has a good game and they want to publish it? What percentage should I look at? And the flip one of that is, if I'm a small company hiring a designer, how much do I pay?
Oh, okay. I've signed five games of five different companies, and the rate that I get, the royalty, so there's two things I'm going to get. I'm going to get an upfront advance, and I'm going to get a royalty, and that varies greatly by publisher. One company, my upfront was $1, and so, hey, this is your signing bonus, is $1, just so we pay you something, and the other one, it was $1,000. And upfront for the upfront payment. And then the percentage I'm going to get as a royalty ranges maybe from 4 to 8%, maybe 10% on a high end if I'm providing an artwork or IP, or it's a smaller company willing to give me more. And that's going to be off what the game companies make, like the wholesale price. So I'm going to make like 4 to 8% on the price we talk about halfway through the chain that the consolidator or the distributor is paying. So I'm going to make 48% of the half of MSRP is not retail.
Some will do it off of the retail price too.
Some of the,
so
but then that's going to
get 1%.
That is going to be even smaller. Yeah, it's going to be even smaller. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, Carbon Edison has a huge infographic where they surveyed several hundred game designers and said, "Hey, tell us your contracts. What was the rate you got? Did you do it up front? Did it include overseas licensing? Did it include digital licensings?" And you can go to the Cardboard Edison, you know, designer contract, it'll come up, and they have probably the best public research on that out there.
Because I want to share everything I can about the process and what I've learned, but that kind of thing I can't share. I don't feel comfortable sharing what I pay people, you know?
Yeah. And sometimes, depending on, if you're going to a smaller indie company, you might be able to negotiate that. If it's a bigger company, you're probably not going to be able to negotiate that, especially if you're a nobody who's done no games before. You're going to take what they offer. They're going to say, "Nah, we'll get somebody else." In the case, I did one with Brian, and I won't talk about the numbers, but I said I want no upfront because I want the Kickstarter goal to be lower, so it's easier for Brian to publish it. So I had no upfront, and Brian said, "Well, we'll give you a better percentage on the back end if the game is successful that way." And so I was like, I'm fine with that. Because, you know, the game may never actually make real money. It may make what I like to call, from my buddy Grant Rodick, lunch money. You know, get your royalty check for this quarter, and it's $23. Like, woohoo, I'll go to Subway.
And your royalty percentage can change based on the channel, too. So yes. I give a different percentage for the Kickstarter amount we might make on a Kickstarter campaign. So I might give maybe 1% of the Kickstarter funding to the game designer because I want them to support it and help promote it. You know, but I'm going to give them a lot more for each copy sold in retail. I might give them a different amount for a game that – so we did Booze Barons together. If somebody in another country publishes Booze Barons, I get a much smaller amount. So, but I want to make sure that the game designer doesn't get cut out of that, and I'll give them a percentage of that as well. So it can. We have a few different areas where we're going to give different percentages.
If you work with a big publisher, there are different negotiating points, too. If it's U.S.-only distribution versus worldwide distribution versus if it's game distribution versus intellectual property, like if they're going to do spin-offs for comic books or movies or whatever, there can be other stuff involved with that, too.
So. I've also seen royalty rates that rise depending on how many copies are sold.
Yes.
So if your game sells 1,000 copies, you get a relatively small royalty rate. But if it blows up and let's say there's 50,000 copies, it's going to go up a couple of percentage.
James Matthew of Minion Games does that. He's very upfront about that. He says, if your game comes out and kind of does the Kickstarter and doesn't really sell that much, you're going to make nothing.
Yeah.
But if your game becomes an evergreen or a big hit, I'm going to pay you a higher percentage than anybody else out there. And that's, you know, so if you can bring me a game that's going to keep selling and keep reprinting, you will make a higher percentage. And that's kind of his deal with designers.
Wow.
Is the way he structures it. Wow. But he also means that you may get nothing if your game is a moderate hit or kind of fizzles. I want to wrap up there so you have time to go to the bathroom or change seats or take a bio break. Our next panel coming up in the same room is running your board game Kickstarter with the same folks, maybe one more. So take a quick break, and then we'll be back to do that one.